studies within economics. This paper reports the results of a series of experiments designed to discredit the psychologist's works as applied to economics. Greffer and Plott listed 13 theories that could explain the original findings and reported carefully designed experiments that tested these theories. One of their hypotheses, which, needless to say, psychologists found patronizing, was that the results were due to the experiment being carried out by psychologists. Eventually, only one hypothesis was left standing. The psychologists were right. Greffer and Plott acknowledged that this hypothesis is the least satisfactory from the point of view of standard preference theory because it allows individual choice to depend on the context in which the choices are made, a clear violation of the coherence doctrine. You might think that this surprising outcome would cause much anguished soul-searching among economists, as a basic assumption of their theory had been successfully challenged. But this is not the way things work in social science, including both psychology and economics. Theoretical beliefs are robust, and it takes much more than one embarrassing finding for established theories to be seriously questioned. In fact, Greffer and Plott's admirably forthright report had little direct effect on the convictions of economists, probably including Greffer and Plott. It contributed, however, to a greater willingness of the community of economists to take psychological research seriously, and thereby greatly advanced the conversation across the boundaries of the disciplines. Categories. How tall is John? If John is 5 feet tall, your answer will depend on his age. He is very tall if he is 6 years old, very short if he is 16. Your System 1 automatically retrieves the relevant norm, and the meaning of the scale of tallness is adjusted automatically. You are also able to match intensities across categories and answer the question, how expensive is a restaurant meal that matches John's height? Your answer will depend on John's age, a much less expensive meal if he is 16 than if he is 6. But now look at this. John is 6. He is 5 feet tall. Jim is 16. He is 5 feet 1 inch tall. In single evaluations, everyone will agree that John is very tall and Jim is not, because they are compared to different norms. If you are asked a directly comparative question, is John as tall as Jim? You will answer that he is not. There is no surprise here and little ambiguity. In other situations, however, the process by which objects and events recruit their own context of comparison can lead to incoherent choices on serious matters. You should not form the impression that single and joint evaluations are always inconsistent, or that judgments are completely chaotic. Our world is broken into categories for which we have norms, such as 6-year-old boys or tables. Judgments and preferences are coherent within categories, but potentially incoherent when the objects that are evaluated belong to different categories. For an example, answer the following three questions. Which do you like more, apples or peaches? Which do you like more, steak or stew? Which do you like more, apples or steak? The first and second questions refer to items that belong to the same category, and you know immediately which you like more. Furthermore, you would have recovered the same ranking from single evaluation. How much do you like apples? And how much do you like peaches? Because apples and peaches both evoke fruit. There will be no preference reversal because different fruits are compared to the same norm and implicitly compared to each other in single as well as in joint evaluation. In contrast to the within category questions, there is no stable answer for the comparison of apples and steak. Unlike apples and peaches, apples and steak are not natural substitutes, and they do not fill the same need. You sometimes want steak and sometimes an apple, but you rarely say that either one will do just as well as the other. Imagine receiving an email from an organization that you generally trust, requesting a contribution to a cause. Dolphins in many breeding locations are threatened by pollution, which is expected to result in a decline of the dolphin population. A special fund, supported by private contributions, has been set up to provide pollution-free breeding locations for dolphins. What associations did this question evoke? Whether or not you were fully aware of them, ideas and memories of related causes came to your mind. Projects intended to preserve endangered species were especially likely to be recalled. Evaluation on the good-bad dimension is an automatic operation of System 1, and you formed a crude impression of the ranking of the dolphin among the species that came to mind. The dolphin is much more charming than, say, ferrets, snails, or carp. It has a highly favorable rank in the set of species to which it is spontaneously compared. The question you must answer is not whether you like dolphins more than carp. You have been asked to come up with a dollar value. Of course, you may not know from the experience of previous solicitations that you never respond to requests of this kind. For a few minutes, imagine yourself as someone who does contribute to such appeals. Like many other difficult questions, the assessment of dollar value can be solved by substitution and intensity matching. The dollar question is difficult, but an easier question is readily available. Because you like dolphins, you will probably feel that saving them is a good cause. The next step, which is also automatic, generates a dollar number by translating the intensity of your liking of dolphins onto a scale of contributions. You have a sense of your scale of previous contributions to environmental causes, which may differ from the scale of your contributions to politics or to the football team of your alma mater. You know what amount would be a very large contribution for you, and what amounts are large, modest, and small. You also have scales for your attitude to species, from like very much to not at all. You are therefore able to translate your attitude onto the dollar scale, moving automatically from like a lot to fairly large contribution, and from there to a number of dollars. On another occasion, you are approached with a different appeal. Farm workers who are exposed to the sun for many hours have a higher rate of skin cancer than the general population. Frequent medical checkups can reduce the risk. A fund will be set up to support medical checkups for threatened groups. Is this an urgent problem? Which category did it evoke as a norm when you assessed urgency? If you automatically categorized the problem as a public health issue, you probably found that the threat of skin cancer in farm workers does not rank very high among these issues, almost certainly lower than the rank of dolphins among endangered species. As you translated your impression of the relative importance of the skin cancer issue into a dollar amount, you might well have come up with a smaller contribution than you offered to protect an endearing animal. In experiments, the dolphins attracted somewhat larger contributions in single evaluation than did the farm workers. Next, consider the two causes in joint evaluation. Which of the two, dolphins or farm workers, deserves a larger dollar contribution? Joint evaluation highlights a feature that was not noticeable in single evaluation, but is recognized as decisive when detected. Farmers are human. Dolphins are not. You knew that, of course, but it was not relevant to the judgment that you made in single evaluation. The fact that dolphins are not human did not arise because all the issues that were activated in your memory shared that feature. The fact that farm workers are human did come to mind because all public health issues involve humans. The narrow framing of single evaluation allowed dolphins to have a higher intensity score, leading to a high rate of contributions by intensity matching. Joint evaluation changes the representation of the issues. The human versus animal feature becomes salient only when the two are seen together. In joint evaluation, people show a solid preference for the farm workers and a willingness to contribute substantially more to their welfare than to the protection of a likable, non-human species. Here again, as in the cases of the Betts and the burglary shooting, the judgments made in single and in joint evaluation will not be consistent. Christopher Shee of the University of Chicago has contributed the following example of preference reversal, among many others of the same type. The objects to be evaluated are second-hand music dictionaries. Dictionary A. Year of publication, 1993. Number of entries, 10,000. Condition, like new. Dictionary B. Year of publication, 1993. Number of entries, 20,000. Condition, cover torn, otherwise like new. When the dictionaries are presented in single evaluation, Dictionary A is valued more highly, but of course the preference changes in joint evaluation. The results illustrates Shee's evaluability hypothesis. The number of entries is given no weight in single evaluation because the numbers are not evaluable on their own. In joint evaluation, in contrast, it is immediately obvious that Dictionary B is superior on this attribute, and it is also apparent that the number of entries is far more important than the condition of the cover. Unjust reversals. There is good reason to believe that the administration of justice is infected by predictable incoherence in several domains. The evidence is drawn in part from experiments, including studies of mock juries, and in part from observation of patterns in legislation, regulation, and litigation. In one experiment, mock jurors recruited from jury rolls in Texas were asked to assess punitive damages in several civil cases. The cases came in pairs, each consisting of one claim for physical injury and one for financial loss. The mock jurors first assessed one of the scenarios, and then they were shown the case with which it was paired and were asked to compare the two. The following are summaries of one pair of cases. Case 1. A child suffered moderate burns when his pajamas caught fire as he was playing with matches. The firm that produced the pajamas had not made them adequately fire-resistant. Case 2. The unscrupulous dealings of a bank caused another bank a loss of $10 million. Half of the participants judged case 1 first in single evaluation, before comparing the two cases in joint evaluation. The sequence was reversed for the other participants. In single evaluation, the jurors awarded higher punitive damages to the defrauded bank than to the burned child, presumably because the size of the financial loss provided a high anchor. When the cases were considered together, however, sympathy for the individual victim prevailed over the anchoring effect, and the jurors increased the award to the child to surpass the award to the bank. Averaging over several such pairs of cases, awards to victims of personal injury were more than twice as large in joint than in single evaluation. The jurors who saw the case of the burned child on its own made an offer that matched the intensity of their feelings. They could not anticipate that the award to the child would appear inadequate in the context of a large award to a financial institution. In joint evaluation, the punitive award to the bank remained anchored on the loss it has sustained, but the award to the burned child increased, reflecting the outrage evoked by negligence that causes injury to a child. As we have seen, Rationality is generally served by broader and more comprehensive frames, and joint evaluation is obviously broader than single evaluation. Of course, you should be wary of joint evaluation when someone who controls what you see has a vested interest in what you choose. Salespeople quickly learn that manipulation of the context in which customers see a good can profoundly influence preferences. Except for such cases of deliberate manipulation, there is a presumption that the comparative judgment, which necessarily involves System 2, is more likely to be stable than single evaluations, which often reflect the intensity of emotional responses of System 1. We would expect that any institution that wishes to elicit thoughtful judgments would seek to provide the judges with a broad context for the assessments of individual cases. I was surprised to learn from Cass Sunstein that jurors who are to assess punitive damages are explicitly prohibited from considering other cases. The legal system, contrary to psychological common sense, favors single evaluation. In another study of incoherence in the legal system, Sunstein compared the administrative punishments that can be imposed by different U.S. government agencies, including the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and the Environmental Protection Agency. He concluded that, within categories, penalties seem extremely sensible, at least in the sense that the more serious harms are punished more severely. For occupational safety and health violations, the largest penalties are for repeated violations, the next largest for violations that are both willful and serious, and the least serious for failures to engage in the requisite record-keeping. It should not surprise you, however, that the size of penalties varied greatly across agencies, in a manner that reflected politics and history more than any global concern for fairness. The fine for a serious violation of the regulations concerning worker safety is capped at $7,000, while a violation of the Wild Bird Conservation Act can result in a fine of up to $25,000. The fines are sensible in the context of other penalties set by each agency, but they appear odd when compared to each other. As in other examples in this chapter, you can see the absurdity only when the two cases are viewed together in a broad frame. The system of administrative penalties is coherent within agencies, but incoherent globally. Speaking of reversals, the BTU units meant nothing to me until I saw how much air conditioning units vary. Joint evaluation was essential. You say this was an outstanding speech because you compared it to her other speeches. Compared to others, she was still inferior. It is often the case that when you broaden the frame, you reach more reasonable decisions. When you see cases in isolation, you are likely to be guided by an emotional reaction of System 1. Chapter 34. Frames and Reality. Italy and France competed in the 2006 final of the World Cup. The next two sentences both describe the outcome. Italy won. France lost. Do those statements have the same meaning? The answer depends entirely on what you mean by meaning. For the purpose of logical reasoning, the two descriptions of the outcome of the match are interchangeable because they designate the same state of the world. As philosophers say, their truth conditions are identical. If one of these sentences is true, then the other is true as well. This is how econs understand things. Their beliefs and preferences are reality-bound. In particular, the objects of their choices are states of the world, which are not affected by the words chosen to describe them. There is another sense of meaning in which Italy won and France lost do not have the same meaning at all. In this sense, The meaning of a sentence is what happens in your associative machinery while you understand it. The two sentences evoke markedly different associations. Italy won evokes thoughts of the Italian team and what it did to win. France lost evokes thoughts of the French team and what it did that caused it to lose, including the memorable headbutt by an Italian player by the French star Zidane. In terms of the associations they bring to mind, how System 1 reacts to them, the two sentences really mean different things. The fact that logically equivalent statements evoke different reactions makes it impossible for humans to be as reliably rational as econs. Emotional framing. Amos and I applied the label of framing effects to the unjustified influences of formulation on beliefs and preferences. This is one of the examples we used. Would you accept a gamble that offers a 10% chance to win $95 and a 90% chance to lose $5? Would you pay $5 to participate in a lottery that offers a 10% chance to win $100 and a 90% chance to win nothing? First, take a moment to convince yourself that the two problems are identical. In both of them, you must decide whether to accept an uncertain prospect that will leave you either richer by $95 or poorer by $5. Someone whose preferences are reality-bound would give the same answer to both questions, but such individuals are rare. In fact, one version attracts many more positive answers. The second. A bad outcome is much more acceptable if it is framed as the cost of a lottery ticket that did not win than if it is simply described as a losing gamble. We should not be surprised. Losses evokes stronger negative feelings than costs. Choices are not reality-bound because System 1 is not reality-bound. The problem we constructed was influenced by what we had learned from Richard Thaler, who told us that when he was a graduate student, he had pinned on his board a card that said, "Costs are not losses." In his early essay on consumer behavior, Thaler described the debate about whether gas stations would be allowed to charge different prices for purchases paid with cash or on credit. The credit card lobby pushed hard to make differential pricing illegal, but it had a fallback position. The difference, if allowed, would be labeled a cash discount, not a credit surcharge. Their psychology was sound. People will more readily forego a discount than pay a surcharge. The two may be economically equivalent, but they are not emotionally equivalent. In an elegant experiment, a team of neuroscientists at the University of College London combined a study of framing effects with recordings of activity in different areas of the brain. In order to provide reliable measures of the brain response, the experiment consisted of many trials. Figure 14 illustrates the two stages of one of these trials. First, the subject is asked to imagine that she received an amount of money, in this example, £50. The subject is then asked to choose between a sure outcome and a gamble on a wheel of chance. If the wheel stops on white, she receives the entire amount. If it stops on black, she gets nothing. The sure outcome is simply the expected value of the gamble, in this case a gain of £20. As shown, the same sure outcome can be framed in two different ways, as keep £20 or as lose £30. The objective outcomes are precisely identical in the two frames, and a reality-bound econ would respond to both in the same way, selecting either the sure thing or the gamble, regardless of the frame. But we already know that the human mind is not bound to reality. Tendencies to approach or avoid are evoked by the words, and we expect System 1 to be biased in favor of the sure option when it is designated as keep, and against that same option when it is designated as lose. The experiment consisted of many trials, and each participant encountered several choice problems in both the keep and the lose frames. As expected, every one of the 20 subjects showed a framing effect. They were more likely to choose the sure thing in the keep frame and more likely to accept the gamble in the lose frame. But the subjects were not all alike. Some were highly susceptible to the framing of the problem. Others mostly made the same choice regardless of the frame, as a reality-bound individual should do. The authors ranked the 20 subjects accordingly and gave the ranking a striking label, the Rationality Index. The activity of the brain was recorded as the subjects made each decision. Later, the trials were separated into two categories. One, trials on which the subject's choice conformed to the frame. Preferred the sure thing in the keep version, preferred the gamble in the loss version. Two, trials in which the choice did not conform to the frame. The remarkable results illustrate the potential of the new discipline of neuroeconomics, the study of what a person's brain does while he makes decisions. Neuroscientists have run thousands of such experiments, and they have learned to expect particular regions of the brain to light up, indicating increased flow of oxygen, which suggests heightened neural activity, depending on the nature of the task. Different regions are active when the individual attends to a visual object, imagines kicking a ball, recognizes a face, or thinks of a house. Other regions light up when the individual is emotionally aroused, is in conflict, or concentrates on solving a problem. Although neuroscientists carefully avoid the language of this part of the brain does such and such, they have learned a great deal about the personalities of different brain regions and the contribution of analyses of brain activity to psychological interpretation has greatly improved. The framing study yielded three main findings. A region that is commonly associated with emotional arousal, the amygdala, was most likely to be active when subjects' choices conformed to the frame. This is just as we would expect if the emotionally loaded words keep and lose produce an immediate tendency to approach the sure thing when it is framed as a gain, or avoid it when it is framed as a loss. The amygdala is accessed very rapidly by emotional stimuli, and it is a likely suspect for involvement in System 1. A brain region known to be associated with conflict and self-control, the anterior cingulate, was more active when subjects did not do what comes naturally, when they chose the sure thing in spite of its being labeled lose. Resisting the inclination of System 1 apparently involves conflict. The most rational subjects, those who were the least susceptible to framing effects, showed enhanced activity in a frontal area of the brain that is implicated in combining emotion and reasoning to guide decisions. Remarkably, the rational individuals were not those who showed the strongest neural evidence of conflict. It appears that these elite participants were, often, not always, reality-bound with little conflict. By joining observations of actual choices with a mapping of neural activity, this study provides a good illustration of how the emotion evoked by a word can leak into the final choice. An experiment that Amos carried out with colleagues at Harvard Medical School is the classic example of emotional framing. Physician participants were given statistics about the outcomes of two treatments for lung cancer, surgery, and radiation. The 5-year survival rates clearly favor surgery, but in the short term, surgery is riskier than radiation. Half the participants read statistics about the survival rates, the others received the same information in terms of mortality rates. The two descriptions of the short-term outcomes of surgery were: the 1-month survival rate is 90%. There is a 10% mortality in the first month. You already know the results. Surgery was much more popular in the former frame. 84% of physicians chose it than in the latter, where 50% favored radiation. The logical equivalence of the two descriptions is transparent, and a reality-bound decision-maker would make the same choice regardless of which version she saw. But System 1, as we have gotten to know it, is rarely indifferent to emotional words. Mortality is bad. Survival is good. And 90% survival sounds encouraging, whereas 10% mortality is frightening. An important finding of the study is that physicians were just as susceptible to the framing effect as medically unsophisticated people, hospital patients, and graduate students in a business school. Medical training is, evidently, no defense against the power of framing. The Keep-Lose study and the survival-mortality experiment differed in one important respect. The participants in the brain imaging study had many trials in which they encountered the different frames. They had an opportunity to recognize the distracting effects of the frames and to simplify their task by adopting a common frame, perhaps by translating the lose amount into its keep equivalent. It would take an intelligent person and an alert system too to learn to do this, and the few participants who managed the feat were probably among the rational agents that the experimenters identified. In contrast, the physicians who read the statistics about the two therapies in the survival frame had no reason to suspect that they would have made a different choice if they had heard the same statistics framed in terms of mortality. Reframing is effortful, and System 2 is normally lazy. Unless there is an obvious reason to do otherwise, most of us passively accept decision problems as they are framed, and therefore rarely have an opportunity to discover the extent to which our preferences are frame-bound rather than reality-bound. Empty intuitions. Amos and I introduced our discussion of framing by an example that has become known as the Asian disease problem. Imagine that the United States is preparing for the outbreak of an unusual Asian disease, which is expected to kill 600 people. Two alternative programs to combat the disease have been proposed. Assume that the exact scientific estimates of the consequences of the programs are as follows. If Program A is adopted, 200 people will be saved. If Program B is adopted, there is a one-third probability that 600 people will be saved, and a two-thirds probability that no people will be saved. A substantial majority of respondents chose Program A. They prefer the certain option over the gamble. The outcomes of the programs are framed differently in a second version. If Program A1 is adopted, 400 people will die. If Program B1 is adopted, there is a one-third probability that nobody will die and a two-thirds probability that 600 people will die. Look closely and compare the two versions. The consequences of Programs A and A1 are identical. So are the consequences of Programs B and B1. In the second frame, however, a large majority of people choose the gamble. The different choices in the two frames fit prospect theory, in which choices between gambles and sure things are resolved differently, depending on whether the outcomes are good or bad. Decision makers tend to prefer the sure thing over the gamble. They are risk averse when the outcomes are good. They tend to reject the sure thing and accept the gamble. They are risk seeking when both outcomes are negative. These conclusions were well established for choices about gambles and sure things in the domain of money. The disease problem shows that the same rule applies when the outcomes are measured in lives saved or lost. In this context as well, the framing experiment reveals that risk-averse and risk-seeking preferences are not reality-bound. Preferences between the same objective outcomes reverse with different formulations. An experience that Amos shared with me adds a grim note to the story. Amos was invited to give a speech to a group of public health professionals, the people who make decisions about vaccines and other programs. He took the opportunity to present them with the Asian disease problem. Half saw the lives saved version, the others answered the lives lost question. Like other people, these professionals were susceptible to the framing effects. It is somewhat worrying that the officials who make decisions that affect everyone's health can be swayed by such a superficial manipulation. But we must get used to the idea that even important decisions are influenced, if not governed, by System 1. Even more troubling is what happens when people are confronted with their inconsistency. You chose to save 200 lives for sure in one formulation, and you chose to gamble rather than accept 400 deaths in the other. Now that you know these choices were inconsistent, how do you decide? The answer is usually embarrassed silence. The intuitions that determined the original choice came from System 1 and had no more moral basis than did the preference for keeping 20 pounds or the aversion to losing 30 pounds. Saving lives with certainty is good. Deaths are bad. Most people find that their system, too, has no moral intuitions of its own to answer the question. I am grateful to the great economist Thomas Schelling for my favorite example of a framing effect, which he described in his book, Choice and Consequence. Schelling's book was written before our work on framing was published, and framing was not his main concern. He reported on his experience teaching a class at the Kennedy School at Harvard, in which the topic was child exemptions in the tax code. Schelling told his students that a standard exemption is allowed for each child and that the amount of the exemption is independent of the taxpayer's income. He asked their opinion of the following proposition. Should the child exemption be larger for the rich than for the poor? Your own intuitions are very likely the same as those of Schelling's students. They found the idea of favoring the rich by a larger exemption completely unacceptable. Schelling then pointed out that the tax law is arbitrary. It assumes the childless family as the default case and reduces the tax by the amount of the exemption for each child. The tax law could, of course, be rewritten with another default case, a family with two children. In this formulation, families with fewer than the default number of children would pay a surcharge. Schelling now asked his students to report their view of another proposition. Should the childless poor pay as large a surcharge as the childless rich? Here again, you probably agree with the students' reaction to this idea, which they rejected with as much vehemence as the first. But Schelling showed his class that they could not logically reject both proposals. Set the two formulations next to each other. The difference between the tax due by a childless family and by a family with two children is described as a reduction of tax in the first version and as an increase in the second. If in the first version you want the poor to receive the same or greater benefit as the rich for having children, then you must want the poor to pay at least the same penalty as the rich for being childless. We can recognize System 1 at work. It delivers an immediate response to any question about rich and poor. When in doubt, favor the poor. The surprising aspect of Schelling's problem is that this apparently simple moral rule does not work reliably. It generates contradictory answers to the same problem, depending on how the problem is framed. And of course you already know the question that comes next. Now that you have seen that your reactions to the problem are influenced by the frame, what is your answer to the question, how should the tax code treat the children of the rich and the poor? Here again, you will probably find yourself dumbfounded. You have moral intuitions about differences between the rich and the poor, but these intuitions depend on an arbitrary reference point, and they are not about the real problem. This problem, the question about actual states of the world, is how much tax individual families should pay, how to fill the cells in the matrix of the tax code. You have no compelling moral intuitions to guide you in solving that problem. Your moral feelings are attached to frames, to descriptions of reality, rather than to reality itself. The message about the nature of framing is stark. Framing should not be viewed as an intervention that masks or distorts an underlying preference, at least in this instance, and also in the problems of the Asian disease and of surgery versus radiation for lung cancer. There is no underlying preference that is masked or distorted by the frame. Our preferences are about framed problems, and our moral intuitions are about descriptions, not about substance. Good frames. Not all frames are equal, and some frames are clearly better than alternative ways to describe or to think about the same thing. Consider the following pair of problems. A woman has bought two $80 tickets to the theater. When she arrives at the theater, she opens her wallet and discovers that the tickets are missing. Will she buy two more tickets to see the play? A woman goes to the theater, intending to buy two tickets that cost $80 each. She arrives at the theater, opens her wallet, and discovers to her dismay that the $160 with which she was going to make the purchase is missing. She could use her credit card. Will she buy the tickets? Respondents who see only one version of this problem reach different conclusions depending on the frame. Most believe that the woman in the first story will go home without seeing the show if she has lost tickets, and most believe that she will charge tickets for the show if she has lost money. The explanation should already be familiar. This problem involves mental accounting and the sunk cost fallacy. The different frames evoke different mental accounts, and the significance of the loss depends on the account to which it is posted. When tickets to a particular show are lost, it is natural to post them to the account associated with that play. The cost appears to have doubled and may now be more than the experience is worth. In contrast, a loss of cash is charged to a general revenue account. The theater patron is slightly poorer than she had thought she was, and the question she is likely to ask herself is whether the small reduction in her disposable wealth will change her decision about paying for tickets. Most respondents thought it would not. The version in which cash was lost leads to more reasonable decisions. It is a better frame because the loss, even if tickets were lost, is sunk, and sunk costs should be ignored. History is irrelevant, and the only issue that matters is the set of options the theater patron has now, and their likely consequences. Whatever she lost, the relevant fact is that she is less wealthy than she was before she opened her wallet. If the person who lost tickets were to ask for my advice, this is what I would say. Would you have bought tickets if you had lost the equivalent amount of cash? If yes, go ahead and buy new ones. Broader frames and inclusive accounts generally lead to more rational decisions. In the next example, two alternative frames evoke different mathematical intuitions, and one is much superior to the other. In an article titled "The MPG Illusion," which appeared in Science magazine in 2008, the psychologists Richard Larrick and Jack Saul identified a case in which passive acceptance of a misleading frame has substantial costs and serious policy consequences. Most car buyers list gas mileage as one of the factors that determine their choice. They know that high-mileage cars have lower operating costs. But the frame that has traditionally been used in the United States, miles per gallon, provides very poor guidance to the decisions of both individuals and policymakers. Consider two car owners who seek to reduce their costs. Adam switches from a gas guzzler of 12 mpg to a slightly less voracious guzzler that runs at 14 mpg. The environmentally virtuous Beth switches from a 30 mpg car to one that runs at 40 mpg. Suppose both drivers travel equal distances over a year. Who will save more gas by switching? You almost certainly share the widespread intuition that Beth's action is more significant than Adam's. She reduced mpg by 10 miles rather than 2, and by a third from 30 to 40 rather than a sixth from 12 to 14. Now engage your system too and work it out. If the two car owners both drive 10,000 miles, Adam will reduce his consumption from a scandalous 833 gallons to a still shocking 714 gallons for a saving of 119 gallons. Beth's use of fuel will drop from 333 gallons to 250, saving only 83 gallons. The mpg frame is wrong, and it should be replaced by the gallons per mile frame, or liters per 100 kilometers, which is used in most other countries. As Larrick and Saul point out, the misleading intuitions fostered by the mpg frame are likely to mislead policymakers as well as car buyers. Under President Obama, Cass Sunstein served as administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. With Richard Thaler, Sunstein co-authored Nudge, which is the basic manual for applying behavioral economics to policy. It was no accident that the fuel economy and environment sticker that will be displayed on every new car starting in 2013 will, for the first time in the United States, include the gallons per mile information. Unfortunately, the correct formulation will be in small print, along with the more familiar mpg information in large print, but the move is in the right direction. The 5-year interval between the publication of the mpg illusion and the implementation of a partial correction is probably a speed record for a significant application of psychological science to public policy. A directive about organ donation in case of accidental death is noted on an individual's driver's license in many countries. The formulation of that directive is another case in which one frame is clearly superior to the other. Few people would argue that the decision of whether or not to donate one's organs is unimportant, but there is strong evidence that most people make their choice thoughtlessly. The evidence comes from a comparison of the rate of organ donation in European countries, which reveals startling differences between neighboring and culturally similar countries. An article published in 2003 noted that the rate of organ donation was close to 100% in Austria, but only 12% in Germany, 86% in Sweden, but only 4% in Denmark. These enormous differences are a framing effect, which is caused by the format of the critical question. The high donation countries have an opt-out form, where individuals who wish not to donate must check an appropriate box. Unless they take this simple action, they are considered willing donors. The low contribution countries have an opt-in form. You must check a box to become a donor. That is all. The best single predictor of whether or not people will donate their organs is the designation of the default option that will be adopted without having to check a box. Unlike other framing effects that have been traced to features of System 1, the organ donation effect is best explained by the laziness of System 2. People will check the box if they have already decided what they wish to do. If they are unprepared for the question, they have to make the effort of thinking whether they want to check the box. I imagine an organ donation form in which people are required to solve a mathematical problem in the box that corresponds to their decision. One of the boxes contains the problem 2 plus 2 equals. The problem in the other box is 13 times 37 equals... The rate of donations would surely be swayed. When the role of formulation is acknowledged, a policy question arises. Which formulation should be adopted? In this case, the answer is straightforward. If you believe that a large supply of donated organs is good for society, you will not be neutral between a formulation that yields almost 100% donations and another formulation that elicits donations from 4% of drivers. As we have seen again and again, an important choice is controlled by an utterly inconsequential feature of the situation. This is embarrassing. It is not how we would wish to make important decisions. Furthermore, it is not how we experience the workings of our mind, but the evidence for these cognitive illusions is undeniable. Count that as a point against the rational agent theory. A theory that is worthy of the name asserts that certain events are impossible. They will not happen if the theory is true. When an impossible event is observed, the theory is falsified. Theories can survive for a long time after conclusive evidence falsifies them, and the rational agent model certainly survived the evidence we have seen, and much other evidence as well. The case of organ donation shows that the debate about human rationality can have a large effect in the real world. A significant difference between believers in the rational agent model and the skeptics who question it is that the believers simply take it for granted that the formulation of a choice cannot determine preferences on significant problems. They will not even be interested in investigating the problem, and so we are often left with inferior outcomes. Skeptics about rationality are not surprised. They are trained to be sensitive to the power of inconsequential factors as determinants of preference. My hope is that readers of this book have acquired this sensitivity. Speaking of frames and reality. They will feel better about what happened if they manage to frame the outcome in terms of how much money they kept rather than how much they lost. Let's reframe the problem by changing the reference point. Imagine we did not own it. How much would we think it is worth? Charge the loss to your mental account of general revenue. You will feel better. They ask you to check the box to opt out of their mailing list. Their list would shrink if they asked you to check a box to opt in. Part 5. Two Selves. Chapter 35. Two Selves. The term utility has had two distinct meanings in its long history. Jeremy Bentham opened his Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation with the famous sentence, "Nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. It is for them alone to point out what we ought to do, as well as to determine what we shall do." In an awkward footnote, Bentham apologized for applying the word utility to these experiences, saying that he had been unable to find a better word. To distinguish Bentham's interpretation of the term, I will call it experienced utility. For the last 100 years, economists have used the same word to mean something else. As economists and decision theorists apply the term, it means wantability, and I have called it decision utility. Expected utility theory, for example, is entirely about the rules of rationality that should govern decision utilities. It has nothing at all to say about hedonic experiences. Of course, the two concepts of utility will coincide if people want what they will enjoy and enjoy what they choose for themselves. And this assumption of coincidence is implicit in the general idea that economic agents are rational. Rational agents are expected to know their tastes, both present and future, and they are supposed to make good decisions that will maximize these interests. Experienced utility. My fascination with the possible discrepancies between experienced utility and decision utility goes back a long way. While Amos and I were still working on prospect theory, I formulated a puzzle, which went like this. Imagine an individual who receives one painful injection every day. There is no adaptation. The pain is the same day to day. Will people attach the same value to reducing the number of planned injections from 20 to 18 as from 6 to 4? Is there any justification for a distinction? I did not collect data, because the outcome was evident. You can verify for yourself that you would pay more to reduce the number of injections by a third from 6 to 4 than by one-tenth from 20 to 18. The decision utility of avoiding two injections is higher in the first case than in the second, and everyone will pay more for the first reduction than for the second. But this difference is absurd. If the pain does not change from day to day, what could justify assigning different utilities to a reduction of the total amount of pain by two injections depending on the number of previous injections? In the terms we would use today, the puzzle introduced the idea that experienced utility could be measured by the number of injections. It also suggested that, at least in some cases, experienced utility is the criterion by which a decision should be assessed. A decision maker who pays different amounts to achieve the same gain of experienced utility, or be spared the same loss, is making a mistake. You may find this observation obvious, but in decision theory, the only basis for judging that a decision is wrong is inconsistency with other preferences. Amos and I discussed the problem, but we did not pursue it. Many years later, I returned to it. Experience and memory. How can experienced utility be measured? How should we answer questions such as, how much pain did Helen suffer during the medical procedure? Or, how much enjoyment did she get from her 20 minutes on the beach? The British economist Francis Edgeworth speculated about this topic in the 19th century and proposed the idea of a hedonometer, an imaginary instrument analogous to the devices used in weather recording stations, which would measure the level of pleasure or pain that an individual experiences at any moment. Experienced utility would vary, much as daily temperature or barometric pressure do, and the results would be plotted as a function of time. The answer to the question of how much pain or pleasure Helen experienced during her medical procedure or vacation would be the area under the curve. Time plays a critical role in Edgeworth's conception. If Helen stays on the beach for 40 minutes instead of 20, and her enjoyment remains as intense, then the total experienced utility of that episode doubles, just as doubling the number of injections makes a course of injections twice as bad. This was Edgeworth's theory, and we now have a precise understanding of the conditions under which his theory holds. The graphs in Figure 15 show profiles of the experiences of two patients undergoing a painful colonoscopy, drawn from a study that Don Redlmeyer and I designed together. Redlmeyer, a physician and researcher at the University of Toronto, carried it out in the early 1990s. This procedure is now routinely administered with an anesthetic as well as an amnesic drug, but these drugs were not as widespread when our data were collected. The patients were prompted every 60 seconds to indicate the level of pain they experienced at the moment. The data shown are on a scale where 0 is no pain at all and 10 is intolerable pain. As you can see, the experience of each patient varied considerably during the procedure, which lasted 8 minutes for patient A, and 24 minutes for patient B. The last reading of zero pain was recorded after the end of the procedure. A total of 154 patients participated in the experiment. The shortest procedure lasted 4 minutes, the longest 69 minutes. Next, consider an easy question. Assuming that the two patients used the scale